Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One. And I appreciate y'all taking time this afternoon to join us for another live edition of Midrats. And for those that are blessing us live with your presence, if you'd like to, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room. We'll be monitoring that during the course of the show. And if you have some observations you'd like to make, or if there is a question that you would like for us to ask our guests, if it doesn't seem like we're quite heading that direction, please go ahead and roll it in there, and we'll be glad to pick it up and try to fold it into the conversation as it goes forward. And if you have to run off to go take care of the dishes or something else and you want to catch up on what you've missed during the course of the show, you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio if you don't get the free podcast over at iTunes or at Stitcher. And with that out of the way, let's go ahead and dive into today's show. The old foreign policy and defense challenges that we talk about here and that everybody reads about, they're always changing. New ones emerge, and the existing ones you think you've got figured out, they'll always morph into something slightly different. The only thing constant is there's no opportunity every 4 years or every 8 years for the new national security chief and the commander-in-chief, as they switch out, to get up and running. The world keeps moving, and there are always some players that take a time of transition to test things out. It happened with our present commander-in-chief, and it will be with our next two. And what we're going to do today is we're going to look at, starting really right now, but unquestionably the first day of office when there's nobody else to look to but yourself, we're going to look at those types of issues that the world is going to present to our new president and their national security team once they get their fingers and claws into the job. We're going to talk about some of the players we've already have been identified to join President-elect Trump and leading our nation, and to touch on those challenges they may be facing and some of the existing ones that maybe will move around in the priority is a returning guest we're real excited to have for the full hour, Mackenzie Eaglin. She is the resident fellow at the Maryland Ware Center for Security Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, where she works on defense strategy, defense budgets, and military readiness. She's worked on defense issues at the House of Representatives and the Senate and at the Pentagon in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and on the Joint Staff. Back in 2014, she served as a staff member to the congressionally mandated National Defense Panel, which is a bipartisan blue ribbon commission established to assess U.S. defense interests and strategic objectives. That followed her previous work as a staff member on the 2010 congressionally mandated bipartisan QDR independent panel that also was established to establish the Pentagon's major defense strategy. Mackenzie has been included in both Defense News' 100 Most Influential People in U.S. Defense. Both years, the publication compiled a list. She's a very prolific writer, and just take a quick Google search to read everything that she's been working on the last few years in defense-related issues, and she's also been called before Congress to testify. She has her undergrad degree from Mercer University in sunny Georgia, and she got her MA from the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Mackenzie, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
Oh, it's what did the Chinese say? May you live in interesting times. And I think we have an interesting time to take you on Midrats, and we've had you on before and after previous elections, and it's always a great opportunity to kind of to step back and look at what type of tides are coming towards our next national security team. And I think it'd be fair to say there are very few people, you know, we were talking and setting up a show a few weeks ago, the thought that we would be uttering the phrase President-elect Trump, But hey, boy howdy, here we are. We've got that. And there's been a lot of gnashing of teeth and rending of clothes and screaming since the election. And at least in the national security venue, and I know you've probably seen this in spades, but I've heard from a few people that I think a lot of that noise is all the good, smart people that we all know and love that invested a lot of time, blood, sweat, and tears producing all these policy papers for what they thought was going to be the president-elect Hillary Clinton administration, that they now are just going to have to push to the back of the room and not maybe be able to recycle with some papers down the road. And
exactly.
That's all kind of spilled milk in an alternative universe, but we have what we have, and it's actually kind of interesting because it's going to force a fresh look in a lot of different areas. And kind of kick things off before we start bouncing around on some of the existing and emerging challenges that the new team's going to have to face. We have found out this week that President-elect Trump has already set up his at least the core of his national security. So from the Don Rumsfeld known knowns, what we know is we have National Security Advisor, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, and the CIA, Kansas Representative Mike Pompeo, and Attorney General, who is probably going to have an interesting confirmation hearing, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions. And I wanted to get your take from somebody in the strike zone there in the Beltway. Knowing those three people, what do you see that they will bring to their jobs with their background and some of the positions they've taken? And what shifts people should look for, which, again, will all be derived from whatever direction and guidance they get from the new administration, what should people expect to see from a sea change point of view?
Well, I like that you said that I'm in the strike zone here inside the Beltway, Sal, because we are called much worse here in the Beltway, right? I'm a member of the establishment, or as Ben Rhodes told The Atlantic in his article about President Obama, I'm really a card-carrying member of the blob. That's specific to foreign policy establishment, so I will be loud and proud, I guess, about that. But, yeah, so what we're going to see here so far, I think that President-elect Trump, I'm going to caveat everything I say about those three candidates for those three jobs with a note that I hope he goes a little more mainstream, moderate slash middle for state and defense, but we can get to that later. And it looks like the people he's interviewing might fit that mold, because why would I even say that? Well, I agree with you about the confirmation hearing for Senator Sessions. That's going to be a tough vote for a lot of Democrats for a variety of reasons. He could not get confirmed previously in the past for a variety of reasons. And I think that a lot of Democrats are going to channel their anger over the appointment of President-elect Trump's chief strategist. I guess that's the job Karl Rove held, I think is the best analogy, of Stephen Bannon. And their concerns over his racial insensitivities, among other things, inflammatory speech, et cetera. But I actually think you'll see those issues come up. But Senator Sessions, he's been on the Judiciary Committee forever and held a variety of leadership positions therein. While he's also been on Armed Services, you know, Judiciary has been his focus area in his time in the Senate, and he's a former prosecutor. So this really means he's a hardliner on immigration, and, you know, he really believes strongly in building the wall, which, yeah, we can laugh a little bit about that. But, you know, I think he's going to bring that hard edge to this issue and try and fulfill the candidate's pledges in immigration, even, yes, down to some wall. I don't actually think it'll be a physical wall in the sense that the candidate has said it. Hopefully, you know, we have the kind of technology now where walls can just be a variety of sensors and other things. But this is really about a hard line on immigration. That's what Senator Sessions means to me. And the other two, Mr. Pompeo, who's currently in the House of Representatives, and retired General Michael Flynn, I think you're seeing a similar vein, a similar tack to what Mr. Trump sees as his core constituencies when he was running for the job before he won. And so Pompeo to the CIA is somebody who probably takes a tougher line on torture. And, of course, you know, we hope that Mr. Trump, the things he said on the campaign trail are different than what he may think and do in the office. You know, the Oval does have a way of moderating and offering temperance to a lot of people's views once they see the big, nasty world we live in and all the capabilities we have to confront it, and, of course, the partisan angle of Washington. But, you know, there are some big questions about torture. He had seemed to endorse at one point possibly illegal methods of torture or returning to waterboarding, possibly torturing families of terrorists, you know, just getting a lot tougher on these kinds of questions. And these days the CIA is in charge of a lot of those kinds of questions. So I think Mr. Pompeo shares that worldview of the candidate as well, you know, not necessarily anything illegal, but just a harder line and a heart attack. I don't think you're going to see a push to close Guantanamo Bay, for example. And then finally, Mike Flynn, he's a controversial lightning rod, frankly, because you know, it's widely known he was fired from his job. This administration, this White House, thought he, I don't want to speak for them, but you know, based on press reports and other things, that you know he was a little too forward-leaning and said some things off the reservation in public that I don't think he was sanctioned necessarily to say. He is a hardliner on Islamic fundamentalism, terrorism, whatever term he calls it, really disavowing the political correctness of what he sees as this administration and this party, not calling terrorism what it is, which is, you know, Islamic fundamentalism. That's a question up for debate. Because the terrorist threats we face, as you guys know, it's much. ISIS is, I think, right now is the most dangerous and the most serious, and it's the wolf closest to the sled. But there are so many other different terrorist groups out there that we are confronting everywhere. You know, whether that's Boko Haram, you know, or Afghanistan, Pakistan. You got Haqqani Network. I mean, there's so many different groups. So. And not all of them are Islamic-affiliated or inspired, et cetera. So he brings, you know, direct access to the commander-in-chief and with these views that I think match the candidates, or now the president-elect. That's a little concerning because that's exactly why I'm going to come back to my first point. I hope that there is two strong personalities as secretaries of state and defense who can offer some competing viewpoints on all of these questions because they seem to just reinforce where the candidate was on the trail.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Afghanistan because I'm sitting here making a list of troubled places that the new administration is going to face. I mean, you've got Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Libya, China, South China Sea, and our friends in Russia, plus the fact that NATO seems to be very defensive with Mr. Trump as the president-elect. I know it's hard to tell this, but we have a lot of other issues. How do you view, if given the names that have been leaked for Secretary of State possibilities or Secretary of Defense, are the people that are being talked about people who are capable and competent in looking at the issues in these difficult parts of the world?
There are some candidates being floated that are in line with the three we've already talked about, meaning people who share the same worldview or view on policy questions that Trump outlined on the trail. That's concerning because then you're just surrounding yourself with people who agree with you. I mean, I understand that's a natural instinct, but not always, not all presidents do that. You know, a lot of them do take a team of rivals approach to get a bunch of different viewpoints. So, like, I would put Rudy Giuliani in that category as someone who shares all of his view, you know, many of his controversial views. And if he were to lead the most prestigious cabinet office, as much as I think it, I would like to think it's defense, it is state, because they are truly the world's diplomat, the world's leading diplomat and leader of the free world representing that face out there. It's a critical job, but I would say other names being floated would serve to, I think, not only just sort of mend fences and build a stronger working relationship with people in Washington that Trump can't get his vision enacted without, so, you know, to be practical about it, but also people who would be respected around the world and be considered thoughtful statesman. And so, you know, the perfect person that comes to mind as a thoughtful statesman to me, of course, is Mitt Romney. But Nikki Haley, Governor of South Carolina, I think, granted, different varying levels here of experience, but I think you can grow into that job and learn it quickly and do it well, you know, with those kinds of backgrounds, as governor of a state, as former governor, as someone who's run for president. Those two candidates are more mainstream, and I think that would be great. You know, the Pentagon appointment, it's all over the place, as you can imagine, the chattering, whispering classes in Washington, but you're still seeing a pretty solid lineup of potential names out there that fall into this second category here of thoughtful, moderate, and respected people.
What's interesting, when you look at the post, let's just go ahead and shoot it, at SecDef, is when you look at the most recent SecDef, they come from a variety of backgrounds, and when you look at some of the names that have been floated by the intro readers, they can come from a professional background of military. There are those that have background in politics, those that have a little bit of one of the two, but have a lot of time in industry. When you look at what, at least during the election, the Trump team was talking about the direction they wanted to take the U.S. military, do you see that a particular background at the SecDef might really be best for the position, or do you think it's more personality-based than background-based?
That is an excellent question. I actually do think about this because it's such a consequential job, right? You're not only seeing, you know, overseeing the world's most powerful military as secretary, but you are, you know, that person with the deputy and the secretary model, you know, they are the face to all of, you know, interlocutor with all of our allies and foreign militaries. They are the ones who really have to go to the mat on Capitol Hill to muscle through a $600+ billion budget every year. That's not a small ask of the taxpayers, as you might imagine. And so it's monumental, right? It's so important to get it right. And there's some have done better than others in this job. And I don't want to insult anyone who's held the position, but I do think there are certain characteristics that absolutely make someone a better leader of this organization than others. For starters, as I joked about being a member of the establishment, you know, I get this desire for change and for outsiders and shake it up and drain the swamp. I have family in Georgia, I have family in Illinois, I have family in Ohio, and every one of them has been telling me for a year that, you know, they knew Trump would win. So I live in the bubble, but I do talk to people outside of the bubble. And I say all that because great to put in change agents into certain jobs, people who aren't from Washington and of Washington. This is not one of them, however, not typically. And I actually made this case to Senator Sessions a few months ago when he was thinking through some of these questions before anybody knew Trump would win. But he had mentioned the candidate would probably likely appoint a business person, you know, the whole Bob McDonald to the Veterans Affairs Department model, as I call it. And this DOD is just too big to wrangle, much less understand, operate, and steer like an ocean liner in the direction you want it to go if you don't have some sense of the basics coming into the job. And, you know, the government is not a business. And so I'm not enamored with, you know, that the idea that business people are always the best ones for these kinds of jobs. But, you know, I don't want someone coming in where it's 4 months to learn the acronyms and understand the power plays. And, you know, the Joint Staff has this, you know, sort of this viewpoint, and OSD policy has this viewpoint. I mean, there's a lot of different factions and power centers inside the building. And it just, you can... the bureaucracy can steer the secretary, not the other way around, if you are not careful. So, or inertia can take over, just like with any large organization, not just DOD. So I do feel strongly it needs to be somebody with a modicum of knowledge coming into the job, not necessarily an insider, but somebody who's steeped in these issues somewhat. And I think, Eagle One, I think you need also a strong personality. So if I look back over the last four secretaries for example, Gates, Hegel, Panetta, and now Dr. Carter. And before Gates, let's add it. Actually, let's go five. Let's add in Rumsfeld. The two most forceful personalities by far were Rumsfeld and Gates. I would say Panetta had an outsized personality, but not necessarily forceful, more partisan, I would say. But a sharp budget mind, but definitely a deal maker. And who are the two that were the most consequential, for good or ill? They were absolutely Rumsfeld and Gates. And you need a strong personality when you have to make controversial decisions, as they both did, whether that's, you know, a surge when the entire country in Iraq doesn't support it, you know, or polling suggests many don't support it. Most members of Congress don't support it. Even the White House at first didn't support it. Or whether that's getting through a base closure, base realignment and closure round. No secretary since Rumsfeld has been able to do that, and part of it was personality driven. He made it an issue, and he jammed it through, and, you know, he made Congress swallow the bitter pill. That's hopeful. You know, you could argue that that's what was needed. It was such a botched job, but we needed it for other reasons, for the excess levels of inventory. And then there's Secretary Gates. You know, his first budget under President Obama, you referenced in my bio, that QDR independent panel, that was a stress test that Congress approved. A Democratic Congress of a Democratic president approved that in a year when Obama had just swept Washington. Why? Because Secretary Gates' first defense budget and strategy under Obama in 2010 was so sweeping, and we all know and you can recall that one, and revolutionary, really, I'm trying to find the right word to characterize, it's decimating, really, of modernization plans on the books, that they stood up that panel to look at the president's proposal under Secretary Gates. Only a strong personality, again, would know what could, I think, have accomplished all of that. And that includes, you know, that the F-22 vote. It was a year later, but in the Senate, I remember Secretary Gates personally working the phone because he took the issue personally, which is a little weird. But, you know, big personalities do matter, and they help the job if you actually want to get things done. It's an organization with, you know, millions of people on the payroll. To get things done is really hard. So you need some knowledge coming in, and you need a big personality, I would argue.
Well, let's talk about those millions of people. I know in your April 2016 AEI report, I guess it is, Framing a Defense Reform Agenda for 2017, you know, you point out that the civilian workforce, both contract and Pentagon civilians, outnumbered the active duty component of our Department of Defense. What kind of strong personality is it going to take to rein in? I mean, you know, it mind boggles that there are 1.4 million civilians, but some of the jobs that they do are absolutely necessary, and there's got to be a number of jobs that are, you know, make work things. Is there a way for a Secretary of Defense to get a handle on those jobs, get rid of the waste of people doing make work, and get the money to where it really needs to go, new equipment, and that sort of thing?
Well, it certainly can't get done without that big personality, because this problem is tough. And let me explain those numbers a little bit, because I think it is a little eye-popping, right, when you think about it. So we have, you know, roughly 1.1 and change million person active duty military, and then we have this defense civilian, like DOD employed, full-time civilian employee to support that active duty and, of course, Guard and Reserve military. There's no actually perfect number. Of course, it's all opaque, and DOD doesn't provide perfect data, but it's roughly 750,000 people. So, and, you know, they work at places like depots and shipyards, of course, but they're also at call centers, and, you know, there are a lot of lawyers, a lot of acquisition contracting officials, et cetera. So it's just a wide-ranging workforce, and it's gigantic. And then we have two armies of civilians employed by the Defense Department. Then there's this other group of civilians, roughly the same size, slightly bigger, actually. These are defense contractors providing services to the department. And so that's like maybe a Booz Allen or an SAIC or a Deloitte kind of person or a lawyer or an acquisition person, you know, when we outsource that in the 90s, we put a lot of that on these kinds of contractors. These are not people building the ships, planes, airplanes, and vehicles of the, you know, that's not those contractors, okay? So there was a fundamental shift in our defense budget about a half a decade ago, which has been pretty concerning, and the trend is not good. And that trend was, of the entire defense budget that buys anything, meaning not healthcare or, you know, paychecks for the civilians in the active duty uniform military, any part of the budget, it was roughly at the peak, like $450 billion or so of the budget in 2010. Over half of that goes to buy services, not stuff, not equipment, not hard power, not things you can kick the tire. So what's services? All the things I just outlined, you know, business services, consulting, contracting, legal, et cetera, engineering, it's a remarkable trend. It reflects, of course, what's happening in our own wider commercial economy, but it's also why you see a military that's shrinking in capacity is because of this shift in the budget. And so what are services? Services are provided by people. It's just, you know, bottoms and seats, as the phrase goes. And that workforce, that shadow civilian workforce, as I call it, is almost 800,000 people. And it absolutely needs to get looked at, but there's almost zero data or visibility into the data, and there's no central collection of that data to even start to get your arms around it. But we absolutely need to get the defense budget back in balance, and that doesn't mean necessarily always up. It means we got to get the money more back into buying things, equipment, hardware, because we need it. It doesn't mean we need zero services, but so just to even one start to understand these workforces and what they all do to support the Defense Department, just let's go back quickly to the pure defense civilian employees, government DOD employees. So, as you mentioned, this is a group of people that provides an essential and critical services to the department. You know, when I worked for the senator from Maine and I would go to Portsmouth Naval Shipyard often, right, those are Navy civilians up there. Okay, yeah, doing God's work, have to have them, brilliant people. Highly skilled, highly trained professionals. But that's like a slice of this workforce. But here's the challenge. It's not that the workforce exists. It's that it grew as the military grew, right? After 2003, particularly when we invaded Iraq, we saw the active duty force, particularly the ground forces, grow slightly, and then we saw the defense civilian workforce grow tremendously. Well, now that the active duty military has shrunk significantly and quickly, we have seen no corresponding, not even to literally almost one billet, shrinking of the defense civilian workforce. Well, that can't be right, because the workload is being reduced for the military, or otherwise, why are we shrinking it? That's a whole asterisk point I'm making, meaning it's up for debate. But why wouldn't we also look at this workforce? In the 90s, under a mostly Democratic administration, Bill Clinton, we had several rounds of base closures, and the defense civilian workforce was cut right alongside almost one-for-one with the active duty force, as it should be. It was cut the wrong way, and there's more about that in the paper, where it basically cut more of the blue-collar workforce and some of the last in or the first out. What it really should have been cutting was the white-collar, the supervisory workforce, because they're the more expensive people, let's be honest. And it's management people are usually not performing those kinds of core functions. So to get at these, one, to just even say we need to examine this and do a careful, thoughtful, targeted, you know, reduction in certain areas of the defense civilian workforce to match the shrinking military, even if it grows again under Trump. The gap is now so large between the growth of the civilians and the cutting of the active duty force. They still would have a larger civilian, relatively speaking, force. Yes, that's going to take somebody with one that even makes it a priority, right? And you really can only have 3 to 4 big ones, I think, as secretary to be to make a stamp and an impact. And you're going to need to really muscle this through. Let me give you an anecdote, an example of how hard it is to do this. I went to a dinner. It was a private off-the-record dinner with a member of the Joint Chiefs, like, I don't know, a couple of 18, 20 months ago. And it was a small crowd, and we were talking about actually the defense civilian workforce and how difficult it has been to examine them. And some services in particular, have active forces have shrunk too far, too fast in the chief's minds, understandably. And so this chief said, look, you know, Congress won't let us do much, not just with excess infrastructure and the closing of unneeded bases, but also by extension, that's really how you get at the civilian workforce, frankly. If you want to make more than sort of a cut here and a nick there, you really do need a base closure around to get major reductions. And so, well, Congress isn't approving that either. And so what DOD is doing is kind of like the death of a thousand cuts. So they're trying to make trims and cuts everywhere they can, both with facilities and buildings and infrastructure, as well as people and workforces. With the authorities that they do have in much smaller amounts, right? 10 people here, 50 people there, that sort of thing. So this chief said he got a phone call from a member of Congress because 7 defense civilians, they were proposing to cut the positions or the billets. And I don't think it was the kind that was even, pink slip, you're fired. It was the, we won't replace them when they're gone kind of thing once they leave the job. This base in particular had, I want to say close to 16,000 civilians, and a member of Congress called because 7 were going to get cut and basically, yelled, screamed, and said over my dead body. That's how hard this is to do.
Yeah, those phone calls can always be quite intriguing because there's really no there's no comfortable way to push back in that if you don't know what type of top cover you have. I wanted to kind of move across the Atlantic a bit because one of the more head-tilting parts of the conversation we saw in the last few months concerned NATO. And as with all of our Western democracies and republics, et cetera, and so forth, elections mean things. And in 2016, we saw Brexit happen with the UK, and that might have some secondary or tertiary impacts in the medium term, maybe even the long term, with security. But there are two of my favorite European nations that I keep closer touch than I could, just kind of keep track over there, is the Netherlands and Estonia. And Estonia recently, as we reach near the end of 2016, they had we think we have challenges with our system. I think it went through a recount, went to Parliament twice. They also have an electoral college, which would be interesting in a population of 1.2 million. But eventually, when they came out the other end, their new prime minister of Estonia, which is small but is a frontline NATO country, their new prime minister is coming from the Center Party, which is variably described as a center to center left populist party, but it really is the Russian party. 75% of the 25% or so of Estonians that are Russian extractions are members of that party. It's a three-party coalition, so it should be fairly diluted from that point of view. But that's just kind of how our situation with NATO will be interesting in next year, is we have big player elections coming up that have, to say non-traditional, I think would be an understatement, especially for somebody from the blob. But one of our favorite parts of the blob, we're very happy to have our blob here. We have the French presidential election comes up where the National Front and Marie Le Pen is no longer an also-ran. We have Germany where Merkel just announced she's going to run for a fourth term, but the CDU is bleeding votes to AfD, the Alternative for Germany party. And the CDU's sister party in Bavaria, CSU, has been kind of interesting for those that follow German politics in the last year, not quite in lockstep with their CDU brethren. And in the Netherlands right now, and I show you what a geek I am, I actually checked the latest polls in the Netherlands Geert Wilders' party is leading for the elections they're having, I believe, in March in the Netherlands, not a small player in NATO. So as the new administration takes charge and starts getting its footing in the first quarter of next year, we could see some significant changes in our NATO structures politically. How do you see the European allies starting to adjust to the shock of the Trump administration, being that some of them, I think, spoke out of turn before the election that they probably should have stayed out of it? And do you see any discussions that could get some insight about what National Front or AFD or even the Dutch party of Geert Wilders, the PVV, what that could potentially steer the conversation during the course of the next year or two with our NATO friends?
Well, that was awesome. Thank you for that update, because I didn't even know a lot of that myself. Yeah, I was just at the British Embassy last week, and so it was great to get, you know, kind of touch base, and after everyone had the chance to sort of take a deep breath. I know everybody's still processing this election. I think even the president-elect himself is still processing, frankly, the win, his surprising win. But, you know, what it speaks to me, a couple of things. You know, I bring up the British because, you know, of the Brexit vote, as you mentioned, but we're seeing similar, you know, there's some overlap of, you know, rejection of the establishment and the elites and the party, you know, the way things, the status quo, you know, across the Atlantic. But really, if you dig a little deeper, and, you know, and that, I think that drives, well, if you dig a little deeper into our election, and I think some that have taken place in Europe and some that you're referencing that are coming up, I see one common denominator, and that is a high debt, low growth global economy, generally speaking. Yeah, that's a sweeping statement, so it's not the same for everything everywhere. But, you know, that's our situation. That's the UK situation, as many other countries. And I think that drives sentiments that are more nationalist, more nativist, more protectionist, and more anti-elite, et cetera, all the things that we talked about. And, every case is unique and different, each country. But you can see some similarities as a result of this. And, you know, hardlining on immigration is an extension of all of that. I think the fundamentals are economic, and it's something we have to think about here, since we help to steer that same global economy. We certainly underpin it with our military, but we do need a more robust economic growth here in the U.S. and elsewhere, and that's going to require, again, we get back to sort of the really hard questions that keep continuously getting deferred, whether that's internal to DOD or when it comes to, you know, federal entitlements like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, that are basically Ponzi scheme run at this point, at least two of the three. We don't actually take in enough tax dollars today to pay for the benefits going out. These are challenges. You know, that's the high debt, low growth situation here. This is a candidate. Let me quickly pivot back to the U.S. Our candidate has said he's comfortable debt financing spending on projects. If he takes that position in Washington, which he may very well, there's not enough money, that's not monopoly money, for Trump to do what he wants to do without debt financing it. This could go either way, right? It could exacerbate the situation we're in, or it could get better temporarily. President Reagan did the same. He increased the debt pretty significantly, also oversaw military buildup, but also had more robust economic growth. So, back to Europe, you know, the allies, a couple of things. I was actually really encouraged by President Obama's meeting with Mr. Trump and his comments afterward. And he basically said, I'm going to make it my priority personally to moderate his views on NATO before I leave this office in January. Thank goodness, right? I don't think there's it, but I will say to Trump, you know, the things he said on the trail, which have made these allies understandably nervous. You know, we all know the talking point that, you know, only five of the 28 NATO countries pay the 2% GDP minimum, but it's a little bit bigger than that, although that's part of it. I think it's okay that Mr. Trump wants to re-examine fundamental questions and assumptions in U.S. foreign and defense policy. I don't see anything wrong with that. Take a policy question, hold it up, put it under the microscope, take it apart, get a bunch of different views, and then settle on an answer. I think the answers will often be the status, you know, what we're already doing. Maybe we can do it better. But the only thing I worry about, not is asking the questions, is that he will accept the answer if it comes back that, no, really, this is, you know, the world's best alliance that's in the best interest of the United States, which is why we do it. It's not for freeloading allies, so to speak, and they're not anyway. They provide other capabilities that we certainly use. Yeah, could they pay more? Sure, let's work on that. But, you know, if the answer is NATO is still the best we got and we couldn't recreate anything better, then I hope he will stick to yes. I think the allies are seeing, or at least hearing, with President Obama's remarks that, you know, that hopefully is the path we're going to go down. It's more of a dialogue than direct action against any particular country, or heaven forbid, you know, some kind of pull out from the alliance. I really don't see that as likely. So having a dialogue is healthy, and I think we should always be doing that, and we should always be reexamining fundamental assumptions and questions. And so let's do that and take our time and get a good answer. And hopefully that's what we're seeing in Europe, and hopefully they believe us when the current president says that's what we're trying to do.
I kind of want to revisit the effect of, and this applies to NATO too, of bureaucracy. As Reagan said, the government bureaucracy is the nearest thing to eternal life on this planet. Mm-hmm. But on our readiness levels, as we look at the defense future, we build these ships like the USS Zumwalt. Suddenly we say, well, we can't pay for the bullets for that particular ship. You know, how much, which I'm fascinated by the fact that along the pathway of weapons procurement, someone doesn't have a separate pathway that says, you know, when this logistics train is going to meet up here, we have to have enough money to pay for bullets for these things. How much of these is the bureaucracy that we have, we're struggling with here in the Department of Defense, the one you described before, how much is that? Do we need, like, President-elect Trump to say, I want to know what it takes to get bullets to the guys out there in the pointy end, and are we doing everything we can to get them what they need? Is that the level of question he has to ask, or is that too simplistic a question given the complexities of our acquisition systems, both nationally and internationally?
I think it is a question he or his representative as the Secretary of Defense absolutely needs to ask. And there's a reason, the rapid acquisition system was stood up at the height of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars by Gates to go around the existing system to get things like more MRAPs and drones and et cetera, body armor even, right? Even in 05, we had kids riding around in 5 tons, you know, when they should have been in, you know, up armored vehicles. And it was just, of course we had to go around it. So yes, and that system, it hasn't changed much, the existing sort of legacy acquisition system. I will say though, there's been a lot of reform of it, you know, starting the McCain-Levin reform bill. I think that was 2011, and that was a monster. I don't know that actually helped more than it hurt. Every time I see a reform bill of that length and magnitude and reaching in and creating more layers and levels of oversight and bureaucracy, I get nervous. And then there's been, of course, this Goldwater Nichols 2.0 or something to that effect on Capitol Hill by Chairman Thornberry and McCain the last basically year. And more acquisition reform, and the centerpiece of this has been acquisition reform this year and last year. You know, so things like they were proposing, you know, basically eliminating like the undersecretary and all kinds of different things. Where does the chairman, should we change the statutory authorities of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, et cetera? Some of that relating to acquisition. So there's been a lot of movement in the reform space in Washington. Was it the right movement? You know, that's really all. That's the question that I think has to be asked. We're really good at adding. Washington is a town where nothing ever gets unwound or wound down or sunsetted. So that's really, or when something's not working, you know, taken off the books, so to speak. And it's why I think that, you know, we have readiness challenges because we have, I think, money problems. I think, you know, the budget, I mean, the chief will tell you, in their own words, President Obama will tell you, because his own defense budget is $113 billion below legal spending limits right now over 5 years for defense. So we have readiness problems because we have money problems, you know, or affordability problem, I suppose you could say, in defense. But we also have readiness problems because we have an acquisition system that is failing in many ways. And just look at the number, or the lack of, I would say, of new, you know, of systems built, of production lines building new systems, not legacy, you know, platforms like a Black Hawk, for example. They're dwindling rapidly, and we've been closing them, you know, when they do, when there is an opportunity like the Boeing Long Beach C-17 plant. That was the only wide-bodied cargo production line we had in the entire country. At the time, or ever, or now, I mean, and we still don't, and then we closed it. Congress agreed to close it several years ago. So there are reasons we have readiness challenges, two sets of reasons, and they both have to be understood, and I agree with you, and those questions have to be asked by the president-elect's candidate for the job. I would like to think it's a high priority. You know, when I look at where Congress is right now with President Obama in terms of the defense policy bill, the difference right now is they're fighting over, the Republicans who wanted to increase defense $18 billion, and President Obama didn't want them to do it in using this emergency money, which is debt finance, basically. Most of that money is going to readiness, because I think there is a consensus it's too low. It's too low across the services, the domains, the capabilities, against which threats, et cetera. So the good news is, whenever there's an additional dollar coming in this year, it's probably going to go toward readiness, but it's still not enough.
And that kind of leads into the next question I wanted to ask, because we talked a little bit about it in last week's show, but the economic facts on the ground for us, especially when you look at what our national debt is, what's happened to it. I think it's either a little more or a little less than doubled in the last 8 years. The headwinds of that low growth that you're talking about. And when you look at our military budget, as you described, it's kind of like all the little birds in the nest. They've got their mouth open and screaming as mom comes in, but she only has one worm, so to speak. But one, at least from the naval side of the house, one of the attention getters has been an issue brought up in the last couple of weeks before the election, was a 350-ship Navy. Without getting significant amount of money from the Army and the Air Force, I really don't see how you can get there from here with everything else that's been described. Is that something you see reasonable within a 10, 15, 20-year time frame, or is that just an aspirational statement that might direct policies when it does come to moving what money there is on the plate around?
I think you framed it very accurately. It takes new real money to even start this. Well, first, actually, it takes political consensus that it needs to get done. And in fact, if there's anything Washington agrees on in defense, it's to grow the Navy. So that's a huge hurdle, and it's an important one to overcome first. I can't say like the Air Force enjoys that same level of support, for example, for its new bomber program or whatever. You know, it's debatable whether there is not that same level of support to necessarily even grow the Army, active duty Army, in Congress. But the votes and the mindset is there to, if we're going to rebuild, it's the Navy is the face of that rebuild. So that's good. That's checked that box, and not all the services can say that. But yes, it's hugely expensive. Can it be done? Yes and no. Yes, meaning, you know, under President Reagan and John Layman, as Secretary of the Navy, as controversial as he may be, he was certainly competent in getting a lot of new ships under contract. Some of it was fuzzy math, right? Repurposing old ships and, you know, counting things that probably didn't need to be counted. But he certainly put a significant number more under contract quickly. That set the Navy up, you know, well for the 90s and beyond. So, yes, this can happen. I think you're going to have to get a creative. Some of our good friends and colleagues like Brian McGrath, you know, how would you do that? You can't do it without small surface combatants, for example. And Brian McGrath recently wrote about this at Hudson. There are, you know, other questions you can ask and answer, but you really have to do a couple of things. You got to get the new money, and you have to go with, for the most part, existing production lines. You have to find a way to build up from what you have now. And the aspirational would be, you know, something new and different and possibly a different supplier or company. To your point on the, you know, the zero-sum approach, yes, you know, if money's not going up or if defense isn't going up in real terms, let me pick on the president-elect. On his website, it says, you know, basically I'm going to pay for this robust buildup. And what there are three pieces to his buildup, three centerpieces. 350 ship Navy, 200,000 active duty Marine Corps, that's 36 battalions, and also to grow the Army almost by 100,000 people, active duty again. And so, and then later in his website at Trump's, it says, you know, we can pay for all this with, like, reforms and audits and efficiency, et cetera. Okay, here's where I laugh out loud, because we all know that's a fantasy. And it doesn't mean we can't do it and we shouldn't do it all the time, and we are doing it, frankly. Right? Congress and Pentagon leaders are doing that. But it doesn't yield that kind of money. And when we add up the bill for Trump's buildup, it's at least $55 to $60 billion per year annually in new money that's needed. You know, Secretary Gates saw this in the 2010-11 timeframe before there was a Budget Control Act. Remember, he was preemptively cutting the defense budget, and then not just capability and capacity, but also the money. And the thinking behind it was, particularly and trickle down to the Air Force leadership at the time, was, and then he introduced that efficiencies in 2011, you recall, things like closing Joint Forces Command, right? The thinking behind that was to free up that money and take that dollar from that efficiency, whatever it is, close Joint Forces Command, and then put it over here in the modernization line item, you know, build new ship X. It never works that way in budgeting. If there's one thing I know in Washington, that's not how the money rolls. For a variety of reasons, declining purchasing power, the cost of doing business, the unbudgeted overruns for anything at DOD in its annual request. You can't pay for this without real money or stealing it from another service. The thing is, I wouldn't say stealing, whatever, giving it. But I don't, you know, I think Washington is at its limit for how members in both parties, how much they want the Army cut anymore. And I think this is the floor. So I don't know that there is money that can come from the other services. Even if you could make that argument, that rationale that we should change the golden ratio, as it's called, the service budget shares, how much goes to each service traditionally and historically, even if that argument were compelling for the Navy, and it often is, I'm not sure how much money there is to be taken. So that's why I would want to see real new money. And how would you get it? Discussion of Medicaid changes, not Medicare, but Medicaid. Well, that would be significant, right? That's one way you could. You can, of course, increase taxes, which they're looking at with some corporate repatriation, something or other. Not my issue area, as you can tell. But you're going to have to get the money somewhere to do this. Otherwise, the 350 ship Navy is aspirational.
Well, one other question that leads to is the influence of innovation on whether or not we should continue to build the 350 ship Navy of the same type we have, which you know, there are certain countries out there that seem to be developing things that would specifically to counter the kind of Navy we currently have. And whether we can, through innovation, stop playing that the game that the asymmetric forces seem to be lining up against us by innovating around them. I mean, is there any vibe at all that you know, with the, obviously we're spending a lot of money on drones and unmanned subsurface and surface vessels and stuff. Is there any effort to really push those kind of innovations forward that can help maybe cut the personnel costs, which are the highest part of our military budget, it seems, and move us forward in the world that we currently face?
Well, broadly speaking, yes, this kind of innovation, and you're hearing my four-month-old who just woke up, so she's coming on the show with me. Broadly speaking, yes, this kind of innovation is underway. Like, for example, the third offset strategy, right, that Bob Work, a deputy secretary, former undersecretary of the Navy, I think he's really the brainchild of this effort. It's happening now to reinvest in military technological supremacy, and that's absolutely needed. And some of the examples you talked about are absolutely questions and solutions they're looking for right now as part of that, because each of the services has a rapid, it's kind of going back to our acquisition point, that rapid capabilities that, you know, these are basically, the Navy in particular has been leading this effort with Virginia-class submarines in particular, to even try and find innovation in through existing platforms and the way that they're designed or configured or used, et cetera. So that's happening, and that's got to happen alongside any buildup if Trump may or may not take on. And see, that my concern is that too many people in Washington think it's an either-or proposition. Oh, well, if we're going to build up, you know, you can abandon. And I've got vibes from press articles that the candidate's campaign team has kind of poo-pooed the third offset and investment in the future. We got to walk and chew gum at the same time. We have to build up capacity now, and we have to innovate for the future. But that innovation happens now, right? And the fruits of that are yielded on someone else's watch, usually 5, 10, 20 years from now, just like stealth, just like GPS in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and precision munitions. We have to do that stuff. We have to have that game-changing technology effort on the books, the disruptive investments. Oh, hello, Claire. She's saying hello to all your listeners. So we got to do both. And right now, there's not an agreement to do both.
Well, we are a family-friendly show, so we're very glad to have Dash 1 and Dash 2 join us. You know, you have all generations have to be involved in making sure the future is prepared for us, so we fully support that. We're rolling things up towards the end of the show, and besides finding replacements for the diaper genie that's going to wear out, I know you're working on some projects. What are some of the things that you're working for that people can keep an eye out open for? And if they wanted to keep a close tabs on the product that you and your friends are and coworkers are working on, where should the listener keep handy in order to catch up on the latest with Mackenzie Aiglin?
Sure. Well, I'm looking at, you know, the numbers, right? Always looking at the numbers. Budget these days is policy, unfortunately. And so I'm tracking, you know, the Budget Control Act. And is there going to be another deal to either get rid of it, wipe it out altogether, or at least amend it as we've seen in recent years with like the Ryan Murray deal, for example, 2-year band-aids on Budget Control Act to take off the threat of sequestration, which could return next year. That's issue number one. You got to do that. Number two is, of course, is this buildup real? And I'll know more about that based on some of the appointments to these key jobs. I'm encouraged by the rumor mill saying that Randy Forbes is looking good to be a potential Secretary of the Navy for Mr. Trump. That I think he could set us on a path to 350 ships if he had the money. He certainly has the skills and talent and expertise to do it. He just needs the dollars. So tracking, you know, the build up, and then finally this, you know, the reason we're tracking that is the modernization bow wave that all the services are confronting. Part of that's driven by the need to modernize the nuclear triad right now, and there's $0 to do it. And the Navy knows this all too well, and among other issues. And so all of that's at AEI.org. All of my stuff is archived there, and my colleagues as well. And, of course, you need to underpin this with a coherent defense strategy. What do you want the military to do? You got to match those ends, ways, and means, something Washington has not done for defense policy in years. So we will revisit this together, the four of us, now that Claire's awake. I hope in, 6 to 9 months, and we have some more meat on the bones, and we can decide if this really, if there's something there to the candidate who becomes president or not.
Amen. Follow the money and follow McKenzie, and she'll help you on that path. Really appreciate your really pleasurable and quick hour, McKenzie. Thank you very much for joining us today, and I look forward to the next chance to talk with you so we can see where we're headed to.
Me too. It's a favorite tradition of mine to come on with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're great, and it's very educational for those of us who are living in flyover country, so thank you.
You're welcome.
Have a great holiday season, and I'd wish all of our listeners, I hope you have a great Thanksgiving. And until we talk to you again, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Piccadilly.